Nur bei falschen Namen, ne? So.
So the Xenon collaboration is an international collaboration. We have 60 scientists in something like 14 or now 15 institutions. I'll go right away with why use Xenon as a target. So you know that we can expect, because of its large mass number, we can expect a high independent interaction, right? But if we can manage to keep to get a low threshold for nuclear recoil, it doesn't have any long-lived radioisotopes. Xenon that you buy commercially will have one, but it can be krypton. Krypton 85 is the isotope, but it can be reduced to low levels. The other very good is the high stopping power of xenon. Because of the high density, also we can have an active volume which really shields against external background and an efficient ventilator. And one of the nice properties is that we can do nuclear recoil discrimination by simultaneous measurements of charge and light. So the principle, just quickly, basically we have a volume of liquid xenon here and then a volume of gaseous xenon above. We apply an electric field between the cathode and an anode up here, in this mesh here. And if there's a particle that comes in and interacts in the xenon, we're going to have a flash of prompt scintillation light, which is going to be detected by the two PMT arrays, mostly this one in the liquid and the other one in the top. And the ionization electrons that are produced are going to be drifted up because of the field, then accelerated, extracted from the liquid because we have a higher field up there. And they're going to produce another scintillation signal, which is proportional to the charge that was deposited here. And this signal is going to be mostly detected by the top array. Now, what we can do with that is that from the time difference of the two, we can determine the z coordinate, because we know the drift time of the electrons up there. And with the pattern on the top array, we can figure out the xy position of the event, because we have a light source basically here. Very functional. From the ratio of charge to light, we can discriminate between nuclear recoils and electron recoils, and that's because there's kind of two sources of scintillation, photons and xenon and other noble gases, and it's one is direct excitation, which produces these excited atoms that combine into sort of excited molecules and then decay and emit photons, or through ionization electrons that recombine and then produce photons again. But by applying the field, we can sort of vary the amount of electrons that recombine, because if I put a very high field, of course, it's going to be harder for the electrons to recombine. And nuclear recoils have higher ionization density, so you're gonna, even if you apply a field, you're still going to see more light from them, more than than for electron recoils. So just a picture of the assembled inner structure of the detector. That's what it looks like. So the original goal of the Xenon 100 experiment was to reduce the background by a factor 100 compared to the Xenon 10 experiment, and to increase the target mass by a factor 10. To do that, to reduce the background, we really carefully screened all the detector materials and then chose those that to build the detector that had the lowest radioactivity in them. The target, so the full volume is 161 kilograms of liquid xenon. It has a target of 62 kilograms, and the veto around it of about 100 kilograms. So here, for example, the target is inside this cage. The cathode is here, so this is where the mesh and the other bottom mesh is here. So the target volume is inside here. And these lines are the field shaping rings that have a uniform field, and we use the Teflon panels to reflect the scintillation light of the xenon. And around it, you see all the CMTs here and above. That's actually also going to be filled with liquid xenon. It's the veto, because we expect WIMPs to scatter only once in the detector, so it's compared to its external backgrounds, which are very likely to interact outside. The details in the instrument paper. So the PMP array, this is the bottom PMP array, very closely packed so that we can detect efficiency of the photon, as much as possible of the photon. It's the top PMP array, and that's sort of in circular rings to help with the positioning of the events in this 2D XY plane. And then here we see the tubes that are in the vitro. That's the cryostat, so the whole structure you saw before is inserted in here. And that's the shield that we have underground to basically shield from external background, to suppress the external background. So we have sort of water outside we can't see here, and then 20 centimeters of lead, 20 centimeters of polyethylene, 5 centimeters of copper. And we have the detector, which is its own vitro. We also have a distillation column, a krypton xenon distillation column, which is installed underground to remove krypton in general, but basically for krypton 85, this radioactive isotope of krypton. When you buy it, it's a beta decay. It has a 10-year half-life. So it's really a beta that's basically exactly, at some point, it's going to look like a nuclear reactor. That's like in one part in 200 or something. So for the goal, we needed a low contamination, but the xenon that you buy is a bit higher than that. So we initially purified and managed to achieve 100 parts per trillion. And if you think about that, that's actually a bit crazy because the isotopic abundance of krypton 85 is 10 to the minus 11. And then you have 100 ppt parts per trillion of krypton in xenon. So we basically have kind of 800,000 atoms in the detector that ends up making a background. So, and then unfortunately, that's what we can hear. So the data that we analyzed recently, there was a leak when we did some maintenance that we discovered later in one of the recirculation pumps. So an additional amount of krypton was introduced, and we figured out that it was actually, after that, it was 700 ppt. So for the results that have been published recently, for the 2009 and 2010 data taking, this is higher krypton contamination. But for this specific, so in this case, it's with the delayed coincidence analysis. So because in 0.43% of the time, the beta decay is going to go, it's going to be a beta gamma coincidence with a gamma like a couple of microseconds after the beta. So you can tag those. So that's how we did for this one. For this, we by using the Monte Carlo spectrum, full spectrum comparison that we did. But actually, we're doing also a delayed coincidence analysis. We're going to have, but I'm very close to that, the number. That's the thing. We managed to reduce. I'll talk a bit more about this, but now the data that we're taking now is with the lower krypton contamination, we managed to reduce this to like more than a factor of 5, so we're back at this 100 ppt level. So the detector is on the ground in this Google Earth view of this, so that's Juan Sasso. Sort of the outside buildings, the tunnel, you drive here, you look at under the mountain range, and conveniently there's an exit, and it's a lab. So xenon 100 is installed here, and it's installed in interferometer tunnel. So here's the highway, you come in the exit, and you can go in the lab. So a typical event from xenon 100, that's a 12 kVR nuclear reactor. So you have, so that's the trace of all the TMTs summed up inside the detector. And you have the F1, very fast pulse, a few tens of nanoseconds, a bit more. Here's the F2, and the zoom of the F2. So if I take this and I plot it in the TMT array, I see concentrated in these few TMTs. So the event really happens here in XY. And then from this distance, I can figure out the depth. And here, there's coincidence with there's an energy deposition in the vitro. So that's the neutron that basically interacted in the vitro and also interacted in the liquid xenon, in the target inside. So since we can measure the position very well with actually something like millimeter resolution, we can correct for signal non-uniformities within the volume. So because we have two light detectors on top and on bottom, the two PNP arrays, so depending where the light is produced within the volume, you're going to have some sort of non-uniformity. So this, for example, is the relative light collection efficiency is a function of radius and z. That's all some data. We take high energy sources and we let them, we move them around the detector and we measure the position and what's the response on the gamma line. So we do that with cesium, americium, beryllium, 40 kV in the elastic line and other lines. They all agree because that's just measuring sort of physical properties of the reflection inside the detector. The other correction that we do is that charges that are produced, or electrons, ionization electrons as they drift, they can be captured by electronegative impurities. So, but the xenon is constantly being recirculated and cleaned. So, you have what we call the electron lifetime. So, basically, the time it can survive before being captured, constantly increasing as it gets, as the liquid xenon gets purified. But we have to correct for that because that means that the F2 signal that we see varies with time and with depth in the detector. So if we compare the electron recoil background with our predictions, so the prediction is the red curve, and that the only input to that is all the materials that we use to build the detector, all the radioactivity of the materials as measured in the slow background counting facility at Gran Sasso. And this prediction is very close to the measured background, to this one. So this is without the veto cut, so, just because we get more events if we leave out. But basically, the measured spectrum and the predicted spectrum agree well. Here you have the 120 ppt krypton contribution. But of course, for the data I'm going to talk about a bit later, it's now increased, right? So the background at low energy, not considering the krypton, is dominated by the PMPs, but in the data of 2010, it's actually dominated by krypton 85. So the background we achieve is indeed lower. So that was xenon 10 here, xenon 100 in the fiducial volume. It is indeed lower than by factor 100. And there's the details of that. For this Monte Carlo comparison. So how do we calibrate the detector? We use cobalt 60 to take low energy Compton scatters. So in this plot here is our discrimination parameter. So the charge over the light, the log of that, the function of energy. The blue line is sort of the median of that distribution. And here is for an americium beryllium source. That's the response. So again, the median is here in red. One thing to notice is that you do have events that, even though it's a cobalt 60 calibration, right, that look like nuclear recoil. So those we call leakage events because they leak into this region away. Experimentally, we see that this is very nearly Gaussian in this log, but at like 99% but then let's say 0.5% is this sort of, and there's kind of models to explain that. I'll talk about this a bit later. But it's crucial, of course, to understand the energy scale to be able to map from the photoelectrons that we measure to the nuclear recoil energy. So how do we do that? It's through this quantity that everybody knows by now, LF. So that's how we, in xenon 100, we use the primary scintillation light frequency, the energy. That was the situation of those measurements at low energy, let's say three recent measurements that we made. So that's another, it's not just a value that we need, it's also an energy-dependent value, and you can see the experimental situation with this. So the direct measurements, which are those dots, was a bit all over the place. So we set out, I mean, we knew about that, of course. I personally was very interested in making a measurement of that. That's what I did. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more now. So that's what we performed recently at Columbia over the course of 6 months, is to do a new measurement of that to lower energy than before. So as another motivation, I mentioned already, but even Sheldon says, what is LS below 4 kVr? So for those that don't find it interesting enough for the physics, as even Hollywood thinks it's interesting. So what did we do? We actually built a new detector specifically for that, with the goal of maximizing the light yield, because you can get a very, very low threshold if you do that. Nothing very complicated. But then the other thing that you have to do is reduce as much as possible the materials near your sensitive volume. So basically, the sensitive volume is this little cube of 6 PMPs all around it. So the photocathode coverage area is more or less maximal. You have a picture of the thing when 1 PMP is removed, so there's very, very little solid angle, which is not covered by a PMP photocathode. What is not covered is with Teflon, which should reflect. So we get a very, the PMPs you see are the same as in Xenon 100 in the bottom array, but they are, they're high QE, they're selected for the high QE, which is about 35 to 35. So we get a very high light yield with that detector, and we get a very low threshold with that. How do we measure LF? Then we record. So basically, we have a neutron source here. We put our tiny detector here, and then we put organic liquid scintillators with neutron gamma discrimination capability in this sort of circle of a fixed scattering angle. So if I just take data in coincidence with these two detectors, then I know that I'll have sort of fixed angle scatters, and the recoil energy in the xenon is going to be fixed by kinematics, because I know the energy of the neutron here, I know the angle. So we take this data, that's one example, then we apply this neutron gamma discrimination cut, so you can see in black, these are all the neutrons that interacted in coincidence in the liquid scintillator and in the xenon cell. And if we take those that are here, and I plot this as a function of the scintillation signal in the liquid xenon detector, then I have some recoil peak. This red, so that's for 6.5 kV, that red point is the point where we measured, tried to measure precisely the trigger efficiency of the xenon detector, and that's the point at which we know that the spectrum is not distorted. So we do have a bump here. How do we extract the LF from that? We basically do a Monte Carlo. First to show us that, so this, for example, is the energy and the rate that we should observe. We also do a model of the neutron generator, which rate we should get. So here you have all the scatters that you should observe, those that are multiply scattering in the detectors, this red component. Little, those that singly scatter, so just only one scatter in the detector, this blue peak. So you see that sort of what I'll measure, so the black spectrum is going to be dominated by neutrons that scatter only once. And that's only because the volume is very tiny. The neutrons won't do.
The purple
is those that interact once in the detector, but maybe somewhere outside. And then we test basically, so that's the way that we extract LF. And so we add an additional parameter, which is part of what Juan was talking about earlier, because we don't know, so there's some spread added to this. The spread of that comes mostly from the dimensions of the detector, because you can have neutrons that scatter at a variety of angles, because I don't have point detectors. But additionally, you have some energy, finite energy resolution, which a priori we don't know all the sources, so we added this R parameter, then we scan R and LF. And the thing to remember is that we're rate constrained, because we measured what's the rate of the xenon, of the neutron generator, how many neutrons are coming out. And so I can't, if I reduce LF a lot, then I don't have enough rate to explain the spectrum I measure. But it can sort of be a little bit compensated by extending this resolution parameter, but not by much. So that's what we do. Here you have the minimum for that point, and then the one sigma and two sigma. Yeah. I have a plot for you for that resolution. at the end, I can show you. Yeah.
You're fitting it over all the points.
We find R separately for every point. Yeah. So, most of what I get, right, is close to an energy plus or minus what we put as U. So if I go in the next one here, look at the results. The black points are new results. This error bar here is the sigma of the nuclear recoil spectrum energies that I have in the detector doing that sort of thing. So we're very happy. I have another slide to talk about the uncertainties that we included here, but anyway, I'm happy with the results that seems to be, first of all, it's very consistent with our previous measurements. These 2 points here. Here, the neutron energy is 2.5 MeV. The previous one was 1 MeV. The detector is different. One was a beam at a very high rate. Now it's with a neutron generator at a lower rate. So I think that's very, very close. Then we managed to go at 3 kVR. We didn't want to go lower because then the efficiency dropped too much. But that's it. And I'll come back to this resolution.
So there's a lot of discussion on the low energy, but even the high energy seems to have suffered from a lot of attacks.
Yeah. So my personal view on that is we should remeasure here also. But it's not easy to do that with one neutron energy because the elastic scattering cross section of neutrons on xenon kind of drops at higher angles. So with low energy neutrons, you cannot measure this region very well. I tried here, and I get this. But of course, there's other things. I see the probability that you scatter at 120 degrees to give that is almost as high to double scatter with multiple low energy scatters that give you a total 120 degree scatter. So. For all of this, it's 2.5 MeV. So we use neutrons produced at 90 degree from the Boucheron direction. So with that, now I'll move to, but I'll come back to this point of the resolution if there's an effect on that. I'll go to the recent Xenon 100 result. So that's 2009-2010. This is the science data. Recently, it was published in PRL, so about 100 days of data. So which cuts do we apply? Sort of basic quality cut, coincidence, threshold, scatter cut, we want single scatters, reducible volume, we chose sort of a big volume because we were dominated by krypton 85. So we chose a big volume, as big as possible, where we understand the detector for the high rejection, not have too much electron recoil, and some advanced cuts. So for example, the arbitrary consistency cuts. If I determine that the position is here in the detector, everything should fit that position. So one example of that is this S2-width consistency cut. So here is the drift time. If I have this cloud of electrons and I drift them up, right? So as I drift them, electron diffusion is going to make my charge cloud become wider. For the S2 that I'll see, every electron is going to produce a tiny, actually we can see single electrons in the detector, so every electron is going to make a tiny S2 signal. If you spread the electrons, you get a wider S2 signal. That's basically this curve, this is the S2 width, a function of more or less depth in the detector. These are actually bins of 10, sorry about that. Yeah, that's 200. So it should be bins of 10 nanoseconds. So it's kind of, yeah, microsecond dish, right? The low width, so basically the 10% height width of the signal. And actually, if we fit that to measurements of the diffusion in liquid xenon along the field, it's consistent with the measurement. So here we just ensure that the width is consistent with here, because we have events that have high width but very low drift time. They actually happen in the gas of the detector. So this is one consistency. Another one is if position algorithms say that the event should be here, then the PMT pattern I see should be consistent with that. In this case, there's a second here. So this event actually has two interactions sort of in the same Z plane of the detector. So when I integrate S2, I get these two things with multiple scatter. On S1, we do the same thing. we build from data a model with the expected light distribution as a function of x, y, z in the detector, and then the TMT pattern that we observe should be consistent with that. So the nuclear recoil acceptance, what changed in the paper that we computed actually the acceptance for different wind masses, and that's because of the changing, because of the S2 threshold, and basically how this goes into the nuclear recoil band. So this is the acceptance of the function of energy inferred with that. We chose a priori to use the profile likelihood approach that was developed earlier to do the analysis. So this one doesn't really need an S2 over S1 sharp cut, I mean, it doesn't have an S2 over S1 sharp cut, but sort of to see what comes out of the box, always interesting to, and we wanted to do a parallel cut-based analysis, so we defined some regions for the energy range, which is common to both these analyses. The rejection power, 99.75% line, so here, zero would be the electron recoil band, which is shifted, and so this is the nuclear recoil band, so that would be the signal in gray, and this would be our signal region. When we, so before I go into the how many events we expect, there's two types of events that we'll have. Electron recoils that leak from the electron recoil band into the detector, into the WIMP region, and also what we call these anomalous leakage events. So one source of that is, for example, a gamma ray that goes there, interacts below the cathode, interacts above, and goes here. We'll only get the electron from here and not from below. We can make cuts to remove these events. So the sum between the S2 over S1 is going to be lower because you'd never get the S2 from that part. Why we can cut these events with this S1 expected pattern, but this only works up to a point, which is basically that we still see, even in calibration data, cobalt 60 data, events that leak even when we apply that. So we use the cobalt 60 data to estimate how much events will get to that. So by applying this rejection, the statistical leakage that we expect was 1.14 events. This is dominated, as I said, by krypton 85. The anomalous leakage that we estimated is 0.6 events. The Mouffant prediction, which comes from Monte Carlo, was 0.11 events. Yeah, because it's 22 sort of milli-DRU now with the krypton and like 5 when it's not. So it's less than of the electron recoil band now, it's quarter or less than a quarter. For that specific one, if we can look in the for the lower krypton, then it's going to be different. Then, when we unblinded, what did we see? 6 events in the box. I'm pretty sure everybody knows, but okay. After looking at the events, we saw that there was some mistake. Some cuts were too lax. So something which is noise, which clearly noise, first of all, because it's not in this one. Periodic, it's seen on PMTs that are not even powered, so that's the empty gap channels. But it's very easy to cut them out afterwards, but we should have been more careful before. But okay, if we apply this post on blinding cut, it removes this, so these are the light dots here, it removes these events, and it's definitely a noise population, has nothing to do with low energy events in this case. Yeah. We have some, but for all the cuts that we have, we always try to go in the very high acceptance end, right? So we don't want to cut out things that we're not sure that. So that specific cut was relaxed. Of course, there's more clever ways to make it to actually remove them. Nobody thought about that. If I have pickup, because that's pickup noise, actually, it's electromagnetic noise picked up by boxes, the filter, the signal. So that's why it's seen on PMPs that are not even on. If we had thought about that, we could have. I'm not, yeah, it's not for convincing, for explaining, but anyway, we're left with these three three events here. That's one of them. Clearly, you'll see later, clearly in the, so that's the radius of the detector, the depth, so the three events clearly like in the middle of the CTC. The probability to observe these three when we are expecting 1.8 is 28%. So, and the profile likelihood analysis, the background on the hypothesis is a value of 31%, so it's not significant. So that's the limit from the published paper recently. This one, the thick line, was changed from the archive version, which I think is going to be updated soon if it hasn't already been, is the low energy part we took into account with S1 acceptance as a function of S2, which decreases for lower mass wind. Here you have the LF, the curve. So the points that we recently measured are the black ones. The fit for what is LF everywhere is done over all the data, but yes, it comes very close to what we measured because the uncertainty in what we measured is lower. And this one, yeah, in mine I checked. Yeah, this one, sorry, is an older one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that's it. The, what I want to see. Yeah.
So you said in dipole data you use all the points for getting the effect.
Yeah, for good or for bad, in the sense that, of course, I do not believe this behavior also. Right? I'm even not so sure that we understand so well what's going on here. Yeah, yeah. So. I have them earlier, right? But. Yeah, but my point is that I don't believe anything. I mean, all these big detectors, right, that have a very. Once they get, if I have a small detector that has 24 photoelectrons per kV, and I can measure here, this one, fine, they want to indicate something, but that's not the measurement, right? Yeah, but measuring LF when I have 2-3 photoelectrons is not the same as putting limits on WIMP if I have 2 photoelectrons. Yes. If I would be working on that, I am not, right? But people. What I can. Yeah. No, I understand that. What I can say is that for this measurement, I'm very happy with the match between the Monte Carlo and the data. So, but here, I don't. This takes into account this. Yeah, because that, I mean, first of all, the point where they say that you should not look at that measurement anymore, right, is not here, higher than that. So, around 10. Yeah, the horn, this one, this horn paper you're talking about. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, so the resolution. So, if I take, so this is sigma over E, the function of recoil energy for the measurement, okay? If I take all the points where I can see clearly the elastic recoil peak, right, which is clearly above threshold, and I measure it just with the fit of the Gaussian on top of the exponential for the random scattering, sort of random angle scattering, then I get these blue triangles, okay? Now, if I fit that with an over root E, or even if I add something constant, this one, okay? Now, if I redo this, so the black points then are the analysis as it is published, with the equivalent sigma over E with the resolution parameter that we inferred, Okay, so it's not very far to get to be just clear. The blue are the data. We put the fit on the recoil spectrum, and we fit that with this dependence, right? Without
the blue, both are data, right?
Both are data, sorry. But this is, I take the spectrum, and I just fit a Gaussian on top of the recoil spectrum, okay? And actually, there's a kind of an exponential background. I have to fit that exponent. But I do that only for points where I clearly see that recoil bump. Okay? Then I fit this behavior with, these data, and I get this resolution. If I take the R parameter that we computed, and I just, from the analysis, the chi-square LF analysis, and I plot what is the sigma over E that corresponds to that is the black point, okay? It's not very far from the other one. Now, if I look at what's the change in LF, if I, instead of using the R parameter, okay, instead of doing a two-parameter fit on LF and this resolution parameter, but I say, no, the resolution is given by this, the dashed, big dashed line, just like this, and I do only a one-parameter fit. The black is the published data, and the open squares are the change, right? So it stays within the error bar all along.
The resolution is a fundamental. Nobody can argue with that. Because LF is based on the number of installation photons that we have.
Yes.
Based on the number of operations of the resolution, through and down, you know, the breaking level. Who knows if this is
the only thing I would have to. Half a percent. But it's very far from something that vanishes. But that's the. So first of all, in the limit, we set the left to zero below 3 kVr. There's no change in the.
Why?
Why?
Because you're
going
around the slope, if you make the left to zero below 2 kVr, if you want to have a slope, the slope is a little.
Yeah, but then don't say that. Then don't say that when it goes here. No, but Juan, don't tell me then that. But this, so if LF varies in here, okay, the limit is already taking this into account by this extra term in the profile likelihood, by the uncertainty, the systematic uncertainty on LF, right? So if LF varies within what I already quoted as the uncertainty, and then on top of that we put the other one. I mean, I'm not saying there's no uncertainty. I'm saying we're trying to make efforts to make things better, right? That's what I did with that measurement. I think so. I think it's a good progress. And what I want to do, I mean, I'm an experimentalist. I'm more interested in trying to resolve some of these things, right? So what I want to do is to measure the charge yield. It has been measured before, but I think we can try and improve that. That's going to be a step forward, I think. Now, whether the limit is truly, what I say is that it's not affected by this because we put in the uncertainty on the left limit, right? Now, actually it goes, so.
Well, that's what's telling you that your LF is because of
this what? Say that again?
With your data, once you put it
no. I said half a percent. No, but absolute. Half a percent, absolute. It changes within this error bar here, right? Right here. Well, not here. Here is what it's here, which is, I don't know what's the 9.3. It didn't measure, right? So. Yeah. I'm not saying the ostrich, but. No, but I cannot put future measurements that haven't been out, so how should I do that?
Let's
have 5 more minutes or more. Yeah. And that's it. Yeah, anyway. Well, no, but I'm done, I guess. I have just the conclusion. So, for the current depth taking, we reduced the krypton concentration. That's a big change. Also, we improved the S2 trigger. We now have a lower trigger threshold. Instead of 300, it's more like 150 photoelectrons. And we started a new dark matter run in early 2011. We already have 140 days accumulated, and we took much, much more electron recoil calibration data, about 15 days of cobalt-60 and thorium-232 to, in comparison, we had 7 days of cobalt-60 for the previous run. So, yeah, stay tuned. Our goal is to basically do a one-year run like this and potentially look for annual modulation, and we're very happy with this data taking. And the future, even on 1 ton, that's what we're thinking about now. The goal would be to reduce by 100 the background, and what else? It's approved. Yeah, recently it was approved for construction in Hall D in Gran Sasso. It would have a 10-meter water shield, and now we're in deep. That means that we're designing now, but let's say optimistically. I guess I'm not the deaf person to talk about this thing. So, I'm sorry, I apologize. The limit is not the one from the recent publisher, doesn't have the modification. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
I can't say because I'm sorry, I'm not, yeah. I know the people that are working on that. So I was very busy with this measurement, that's what I've been doing. Others are busy with other things. Yeah, definitely.
So can you, for the linear resolution data, can you use that, I mean, therefore, you can draw an axle for that space that you can draw from.
Yes.
Then
take so you mean for the LF? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You
have
the photo resolution.
This is, yes.
Now you can basically get rid of all the axes but not by just taking the body, but by taking the.
Yeah.
And then
we could add that as a systematic uncertainty on the limit if we take that into account.
So you think that already takes a lot of this into account?
Yeah, it's just a matter of certain energy resolution. But yeah, we basically assume more basically the fit approach rather than measuring.
The problem, I mean, the criticism I would have is that In your case, I think it could only take the high energy points, right? And there, the resolution is kind of dominated by other things, because it's not just a pure elastic scatter peak that I have, right? You have a lot of multiple scatter contributions.
There's some multiple scatter, but it's pretty cool.
So when if we fix the resolution, if I fix it, then I go into low energies, where somewhere I haven't measured, it's the same type of extrapolation, right? If I'm taking
That's why we have to put big uncertainties in the resolution.
Okay.
I think it's unlikely that the resolution is constant between 3 and 8 kV or whatever.
Okay, so in hydrodynamics and chemistry.